Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The pandemic revealed and exacerbated a mental health crisis among youth across the country. In Sacramento, the public health department, in tandem with school districts, are responding to an overwhelming number of students in need of support. And that need falls disproportionately on the most vulnerable youth, including students of color. The county is investing in mental health resources on campuses, but the pace is struggling to meet the demand. CAP Radio Sacramento education reporter Shrishti Prabha has been following the county's progress, learning that one solution involves leaning on community organizations to fill the gap. And most importantly, listening to those living through these challenges, youth. Shrishti, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me, Vicky.
So this is a continuation of your reporting. The last time you joined us, you told us that there were 40 school psychologists for 300 schools in Sacramento County. Now, this was part of a pilot program that County Superintendent Dave Gordon shared with us on Insight at the beginning of the year to place a mental health clinician at every campus. At the time, he said this wasn't really being done elsewhere in the state. So what's the progress on how this program is scaling up?
So like we talked about last time, jumping from 20 to 40 for 300 schools feels like not enough. And after some digging, it's very clear that there's a shortage of mental health professionals in California. So this is happening on average, but this is also true in Sacramento. Many districts are independently adding 20 to 30 psychologists to address the issue, but I'm not sure that would be enough to reduce the ratios, which I'll expand upon later. However, in the last year, Sacramento County Public Health Department had to support 12,000 students. And so that's an average of 1,000 students requiring services a month. And I mean, that's a crazy number, and it requires appropriate systems in place.
Right. I mean, 1,000 students a month for, you know, a few dozen school psychologists that are currently available. Let's focus on the students behind these numbers. What are their needs? What did you learn about what they're facing?
Yeah, so we previously spoke about the public health department's findings in Sacramento, where 40% of students in Sacramento were facing or reporting feelings of sadness and hopelessness. But that number actually reaches up to 70% for vulnerable populations like unhoused students, foster youth, Latin and Black students, queer youth, students of color. So that exists.
Do you think the data is a fair representation?
I actually think it's not. I think it may be underrepresenting mental health incidences in the county. And I spoke to clinical psychologists at the UCLA Center for Public Health Policy, Dr. Blanche Wright, who mentioned that the data might not be telling of what is happening in the here and now.
And sometimes it's only a piece of the pie. You know, you ask about sadness and hopelessness. That's one type of mental health challenge, but there's a lot of other types that maybe are not always represented in data that we're getting.
Yeah, and then it's layered because there's also this complexity of cultural stigma. So I spoke with 18-year-old Black woman, Amari Haysbert, who just graduated from Hiram Johnson right here in Sacramento, and she tells me of how generational trauma can potentially silence Black women from reporting mental health-related concerns.
Yes, generational trauma is it's a very big thing, especially with women of color. There's a lot of sit down and be quiet that you pass on to your daughters over and over and over again. And that causes for different types of, like, when different situations arise, you react on how your parents taught you to. So when there's a situation where you need to speak up and you do not speak up, it's not always because you feel like, oh, me speaking up is bad. It's bad because I think it's bad. It's my mom told me to be quiet when I was younger and to keep my mouth closed. So that's what I'm going to do.
Oh, I can identify with that. I mean, when I was a kid, I was told like crying is weakness, you know, and so not being in touch with that vulnerability. When it comes to schools, we're learning that, you know, they're just chipping away at additional support. It's not enough, as we're learning from your reporting. But is it making a dent in helping alleviate the youth mental health crisis in Sacramento?
Yeah, to be honest, there needs to be more investment. Some of the numbers that I found truly unnerving were the ratios of students per mental health professional, which I mentioned earlier. So in Sacramento County during the 2019 and 2020 school year, there were almost 6,300 students allotted to one social worker, 1,300 students allotted to one school psychologist, and almost 700 students allotted to one school counselor.
Yeah, that's just not even realistic in what one person can shoulder. What is actually the recommendation number when it comes to students per mental health personnel?
So 250 for a school psychologist is what was recommended. But we are well above the recommended numbers in Sacramento. And Dr. Imelda Padilla-Frasto, a research scientist at the UCLA Center for Public Health Health Policy Research, said to me that even this caseload can be too much for one clinician.
I think we need to do better in general. But I think what these ratios mean is that it's, you know, among these 500 students, you know, one in three, maybe one in two are going to have mental health problems. So they're really only seeing about, you know, 250 students. But even that is still, you know, can be a really large caseload for school psychologists. And so, you know, I really think what needs to happen is there just needs to be more programs that serve a larger number of students on mental wellness.
And this data that we're talking about is from 2 years ago. So much has happened in the past 2 years, from remote learning, hybrid learning. Are there any updated numbers?
Yeah, that's a really good point, Vicky. So unfortunately, even though I was out there trying to find this data, we don't have the exact same data, but the American School Counselor Association did find that during the 2020 and 2021 school year, there were 600 students for one school counselor in California. So the problem persists. However, I do want to talk about data because it was quite difficult to find. And like all data, it takes time to collect, it requires funding, and then it helps position policy. So I spoke to two UCLA researchers, which you've heard from, Dr. Imelda Padilla-Frasto and Dr. Blanche Wright, who are both finding that they're facing barriers in just funding for the research and funding to, you know, actually analyze the data that might exist or actually providing that data. And then when they write these policy briefs, they're finding a lack of response to them.
So a lack of response in addition to a lack of sustainable funding for their research. Why are they being left unread when I think overall there is an acknowledgement that this is a crisis, a youth mental health crisis across the country, including California, including Sacramento?
I think it just comes down to money, right? When you send out these policy briefs and they're being circulated, it's asking for more money for something. And, whether that's like funding local organizations or funding programs or funding policy or funding whatever, it requires money. And I think, unfortunately, this isn't the top priority, even though it's very clear that this is something that needs to be addressed, which is why I did this reporting, because I think it's obvious that we need the help, but people are just letting it fall to the wayside.
Well, and what you learned is there are some solutions being applied, at least at the local level. So let's focus on that. What's being done?
So what I'm seeing is that local community-based organizations are stepping in and they're partnering with districts to pilot these mental wellness programs on campus in the Sacramento area.
And this is kind of just starting. It's in its infancy. Are you finding that this is a good model?
So it's actually not fully in its infancy. Some are new, which I'll talk to you a little more about, but some are kind of old and have been around and actually have been partnered with the schools for a minute.
Well, so that's great and have that experience.
Exactly. So that it means that the districts have already tried to invest, especially culturally competent type of mental wellness programs. And one of those is Improve Your Tomorrow. But I think the main thing is that these programs need to be at the districts and schools because that is the best point of intervention. So I spoke with another young woman, Jenna Lynn Fan, who told me that despite all the adversity she faced, she found herself in a mental wellness program called IQ Squad because it was on the school campus.
I didn't have a good foundation. I didn't have, my parents were separated. I rarely saw my dad. I was kind of like sleeping on the streets, train stations, stuff like that when I was a little kid. My mom wasn't present. But one thing I always did was take myself to school though.
Yeah, you know, finding that stability and meeting people where they are, which in her case was school on campus.
Yeah, exactly. And Dr. Padilla Frausto affirmed what I had been researching. She felt community orgs can offset that burden from the schools on and the districts onto the community. The mental wellness programs provided by these local nonprofits local nonprofits can be more culturally competent since the organizations are based in the community. So Jen and Amari, who we've both heard speak during this segment, were part of the program IQ Squad, which has partnered with local nonprofit Youth Forward to deliver on-site services at Harem Johnson, Luther Burbank, McClatchy, and American Legion High School in Sac City Unified.
So what do these programs look like?
So, yeah, Youth Forward is one of the many programs, and I'll tell you a little bit about Youth Forward. So the IQ Squad program, they call themselves the She Movement, which is empowering women of color, empowering women in general to speak up and acknowledge when they're having these issues with their mental health or even just being empowered enough to speak up and voice their concerns. The Center for Sierra Health Foundation is also being funded by the County Public Health Department to have organizations for Black and other vulnerable youth on site. So we have Roberts Family Development Center, which works on literacy and youth. You have Improve Your Tomorrow, which is actually for mental wellness and academic success for Black boys. On Track, which is a culturally responsive mental wellness program for Black youth. And Rose Family Creative Empowerment Center, socially and cultural poverty programs for arts and education.
Wow. So they're addressing so many needs. How are students responding to these programs?
Yeah, I think it's imperative that we hear from the students because they actually can communicate their needs the best. And they're so smart. I want to reference IQ Squad once again because I was at the table with program director Nakia Bell and her two students, Amari and Jen. And it was quite an emotional experience to be in this room. I want you to hear a little of how this interaction impacted the person on the ground advocating for these women.
Because without Miss Kia, without my sister forcing me to wake up on Saturdays to go to IQ Squad, I wouldn't be here. I would have either been in a worse situation, I probably wouldn't be here at all, or I just would be the same standard uniform Mari, where you have to hide yourself. But I'm not no more. And I'm not... Can't give all the credit to Miss Kia, but you have no choice but to be like, I'm needed. And that feels amazing. Like, I wish I could say, I don't know what words can amount to how thankful I am for you, but I am so thankful.
Do you have anything to say?
I'm
sorry.
I didn't expect to come here. I'm not even a crier. But seeing her repeat, oh my God. Let me leave clear my throat. Seeing her share her story, it's heartbreaking to know that she had to suffer, that she had to struggle. And just being able to say that I see you, that I recognize your light, her brilliance, because she is. When Amari is in the space, when you have that opportunity to hear her speak, to share her insight, you're like, that human being is amazing and her future is bright. And I'm just so grateful that she felt I played a part in that. And all it was bringing these young folk into this space and letting them know that you belong here, that you have value, that you are so worthy, and that you are enough.
That is so powerful.
Yeah, it was really incredible to be in the space with these two young women who felt empowered enough to be vulnerable with me. I think that's the power of a program like IQ Squad, where the adults delivering the services are invested and they're consistent. That's why programs like this work. Both women communicated to me that they might not have been alive without the program, which was really hard to hear. These amazing and brilliant women suffered COVID, being unhoused, sexual abuse, unstable family structures. But with Nakia's support, they were able to emerge on the other end of it. So IQ Squad did more than just that. afterwards, they even provided them careers post-graduation. So their goal was to empower women of color, and they managed to do that with Amari and Jen. And I saw the power of their work firsthand while I was doing the reporting.
Yeah, and that's just, it's just wonderful and just so powerful that they opened up with you and wanted to share that. In the last 20 seconds or so that we have, where are we at with funding? What is coming up this fall and even with this election?
Right. So all organizations I mentioned are part of the SAC Kids First Coalition to pass Measure L on the November ballot to generate funding for Sacramento youth. Measure L would allocate roughly $10 million from the general fund, or the equivalent of 40% of the annual cannabis business tax revenue, to promote positive youth development and youth violence prevention.
So the work continues for you, Srishti.
Yes.
Srishti Prabha is CAP Radio Sacramento education reporter. You can find more information on Srishti's reporting at CAP Radio's website, as well as our Insight page. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The United States has a lot of work to do when it comes to children's rights. That's according to Human Rights Watch, an international nonprofit which reports every state, including California, is falling behind international standards when judged on four metrics: child marriage, child labor, juvenile incarceration, and corporal punishment. According to the scorecard, almost all states received a grade of D or F, including our state, which received a D overall. No states received a grade of A or B. To top it off, the United States as a whole is an outlier in adopting international standards to protect children when compared to nearly 200 other countries. We're going to take time today to better understand why and hear some solutions to improve the rights of children in California. I spoke with Elizabeth Calvin, Senior Advocate for Human Rights Watch Children's Division, and Dr. Elizabeth Barnert, a professor of pediatrics at UCLA and a juvenile justice policy advisor at the state legislature, as well as Congress. All right. Well, since we have two Elizabeths, I'm going to use last names too. So I'm going to start off with you, Elizabeth Calvin. Tell us more about your role with Human Rights Watch in the Children's Rights Division.
Yes, I'm based in California, and my focus is on youth justice, meaning how the state and how communities respond to children and young adults who are accused of crimes. And really, our goals in this work are focused on a system that is more healing, more health-focused, more based on research that shows what works when we address the needs of children who have committed crimes. So the three main areas that I work on are ending the transfer of children to the adult criminal court where they face adult penalties, ending the use of extremely long sentences, including the sentence of life with no possibility of parole for people under the age of 18, and being a part of transforming the youth justice system so that it is really health and healing focused for everyone involved, people who are accused of crimes and communities and those who have been the victims of crime.
And this was just one of four components that this scorecard looked at. And I got to tell you, when I looked at the scorecard, I was really shocked to see how much work the United States, and including California, which is considered one of the most progressive states in the country, has to go. And the four components that the scorecard was looking at was child marriage, corporal punishment, child labor, and juvenile justice. As you just said, What stands out to you about California? Because I think overall, and California is not alone in this, it was one of the majority of states that received a D or an F, and California received a D overall.
Yeah, I mean, I think this should be kind of a rude awakening for Californians and actually for Americans in general, because we did look at every single state and no state received an A, no state received a B. You know, some states received a C, others received D and F. And I just think what we found is that while many Americans and Californians in particular might think that we are upholding the rights of children, in fact, the opposite is true, particularly for the four areas that we chose. When I look at California, I think what we see is really, you know, a pretty abysmal record. We've definitely made progress in the area of youth justice, but there's definitely, you know, a long way to go. And when we look at corporal punishment, child labor, and child marriage, California is awful.
These standards that this scorecard basically judge states on in the United States were set by the United Nations. It's the Convention on the Rights of the Child. What I also found pretty shocking was that it was adopted by nearly 200 countries, I believe 196 over the last three decades. But the United States is the only country which hasn't ratified and adopted this international agreement on a federal level. They divert it to the states. Why is that?
Wow. Yeah, that's, you know, the Convention on the Rights of the Child is the most ratified international treaty ever. And the U.S. is the only U.N. member country that has not ratified it. You know, my understanding is one reason it was not ratified is the U.S. Did not want to agree that it would not sentence children to life in prison with no possibility of parole, that was one of the sticking points. You know, the way that U.S. law works, most of these issues, most of these laws are going to be things that happen at the state level and not the federal level. One exception to that is labor law, but most of these things are handled at the state level. And so that's why we see this kind of patchwork of laws, because there's just different jurisdictions, 50 different jurisdictions that are handling whether to live up to the Convention on the Rights of the Child or not.
Is that problematic to you that it's left to individual states as opposed to having federal policies in place when it comes to the rights of children?
Certainly. It just seems that there are a few things that are as important for a country to do than to protect its most vulnerable citizens. And young people, particularly young people who are facing the possibility of child marriage or corporal punishment or working in hazardous conditions or being put in prison are particularly vulnerable. And yes, I think it would be very, very powerful if the federal government really took a stance on these issues and others that are in the Convention on the Rights of the Child. I think it would convey to states that they should be changing their laws. And in fact, the federal government has the power of persuasion also in terms of funding, and other guidelines that they can use to have states treat their children better.
Especially on that topic of child marriage, your organization, Human Rights Watch, for the scorecard, partnered with other nonprofits. On this arm, it was Unchained at Last, which is a nonprofit that's focused on ending forced and child marriage in the United States. Once again, I was surprised that nearly 300,000 children, according to this nonprofit, were married in America between 2000 and 2018, some of them as young as 10 years old, and that California is one of eight states without a minimum age for marriage. I guess, what have been the consequences that you have seen in states failing to establish a minimum age of like 18 years old or not having a minimum age at all?
Well, I mean, I do want to put a finer point on it that a study by McGill University estimated that more than 23,000 children in California between those same dates of 2000 to 2018 were in child marriages, had been married as children. So that's a lot in California itself. And the research is pretty clear. Child marriage results in early pregnancy, It results in reduced educational achievement. It can result in mental health issues. And it certainly results in increased violence and also, in other words, people being victims of violence and also poverty.
Yeah. I mean, and also just thinking about child labor, you know, the work in agriculture, I believe the minimum age to work in agriculture in California has a heavy agriculture workforce is 12 years old.
That's right.
I remember working on the border, the Texas-Mexico border. There are migrant students that, you know, the districts understand that they're not there for an entire school year, that for a portion of the school year, they go with their families up to other states and they work in migrant labor. But according to the U.S. Department of Labor's most recent survey of California farm workers, 3% of farm laborers are between the ages of 14 and 19. So that seems like a relatively slim number. But your report also found that within that, there's an overrepresentation in worker injuries and fatalities when it comes to minors who are in this workforce. What should we understand about minors that are engaging and working in agriculture in California and the risks that come with it?
Well, actually, it was a U.S. government study in 2018 that found that children in agriculture account for half of work-related deaths, even though they are, as you mentioned, only 3% of child workers. So that's a pretty shocking and terrible result. And the reason is because in a place like California, the minimum age is 12. And when we say the minimum age is 12, they can work full time at age 12. And the minimum age in California for hazardous work is 16. Now, the international standard on that is that no child under age 15 should be working in fields, and no child, period. No one under age 18 should be doing hazardous work. So examples of hazardous works are, you know, using equipment that is heavy equipment or potentially dangerous equipment. In the South, where tobacco is grown, there are hazards that come from touching the wet leaves, and it transfers nicotine. And we've found in studies, Human Rights Watch has found in studies there, that children oftentimes have nicotine poisoning and are throwing up and dizzy and have headaches. And we don't know about long-term effects. I mean, I think these are things that are understood internationally, that the standard should be 15 in order to work in any job and no hazardous work under age 18.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Elizabeth Calvin with Human Rights Watch about how the United States, including California, is falling short on children's rights, according to its recent scorecard. So we're going to get to those other two components. Let's bring in Dr. Elizabeth Barnard at UCLA, a professor in pediatrics, as well as a juvenile justice policy advisor. You advise both the California State Legislature and U.S. Congress on juvenile justice policy. Your research has contributed to the passage of a handful of reforms here in California. Just starting from the beginning, when did your career in this begin?
I've been doing research in the field of youth justice since my residency training. I had a patient who was systems involved. I was taken care of on a regular basis at a federally qualified health center, and I wanted to understand him better and how to help him. And I did a research study with young people who were incarcerated. And I think the most important thing I learned, the study was on a meditation intervention for incarcerated youth. And I learned that they were young people who just wanted, you know, to do better and the best chance to succeed. I think in our society, we have a tendency to cast the kids aside, to think of the kids as failures, and most importantly, to forget that they are children, which is why this Human Rights Watch report is not surprising, and it's so helpful because it reminds us that these are kids. And so then in throughout my career, fellowship training and my research, I really focus on bringing in the public health angle, trying to understand the relationship between health and young people's justice involvement. So how can we better take care of the health of young people who are in the system? And how can we use a health lens to understand how to meet the needs of young people so they don't end up in the system at all?
I mean, you touched upon this part about society casting aside and even just forgetting the fact that these are children. what does the general public not think about but should think about when it comes to juvenile justice?
Well, I think what we need to understand is that the youth justice system should really be used as a last resort. That's one of the fundamental principles in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, that children have the right to be healthy, to have the supports they need to develop and thrive. And so locking kids up is not an answer that's going to increase public safety, in addition to it being a violation of children's rights. So I think people need to understand when we think of children, we need to think of them as children. Think about how can we get them what they need in schools? How can we design mental health systems that meet their needs? How can we help everybody have the healthiest society?
Are there recurring ailments or health issues that you see in your research?
Absolutely. So the young people who are incarcerated face a lot of health inequities, and these health inequities overlap with the same risks that make it more likely for somebody to end up in the carceral system. So young people who are involved in the criminal legal system have much higher rates of mental illness, extremely high rates of exposure to prior trauma, very high sexual and reproductive health needs as well. So for example, 1 in 3 girls who are incarcerated, and this is from a nationally representative study in the United States, report ever having been pregnant. And 1 in 12 boys or girls who are incarcerated are teen parents. So what we're seeing is intergenerational transmission of risk with health disparities and cycles of carceral involvement.
In your viewpoint, where does policy fit in, given that you're a policy advisor to help curb and solve these systemic and, as you say, generational issues?
So there is a lot that can be done to transform our youth justice system and our response to young people. Elizabeth Calvin mentioned, for example, the Juvenile Life Without Parole, which thanks to her work through Human Rights Watch, we've now ended in California. Another important example is the minimum age of juvenile court prosecution. So that was one of the elements looked at in the Human Rights Watch report. So California right now has a minimum age of 12, meaning that we recognize that children 11 and younger are too young to understand or benefit from being processed in the juvenile legal system. This falls short of the recommendations of the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child, which recommends a minimum age of at least 14. But it's an example where setting a hard policy line can really make a difference to protect kids. So I did research in this area in California with my research partner, Laura Abrams. And we requested data from the California Department of Justice because at the time, people really weren't talking about this issue. And to give you an example, in 2015, there were over 500 children less than 12 years old referred to probation in California. And the youngest child was 5 years old. That child was a Black boy who was referred for a curfew violation. And when we've looked at the data in California and across the country, what we see is that the racial disparities creep in at the youngest ages. So we know that the juvenile legal system is incredibly racially biased. The lifetime risk of imprisonment in the United States for a Black man is 1 in 3. That is a mind-boggling figure from the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics. And when you look at the youngest kids, there's an even greater disproportionality at the youngest ages with Black boys. Young Black children ending up in the juvenile legal system when we don't have these hardline policy laws. So Dr. Abrams and I interviewed people around the country about this question of children's involvement. And what we found is that every single point where someone is making a decision, where there's prosecutorial discretion or where a judge is making a decision, racial bias creeps in. And so it's very important to have policies that protect all children from involvement in the system. The recommendations, the principles in the United Nations Conventions on the Rights of the Child would take the United States and California very far along in terms of universally protecting children from the harms of the juvenile legal system.
When you talk to Congress members, when you talk to state lawmakers, what do you hear? I mean, when you're having conversations trying to get them collectively to adopt international standards, what do they tell you in response? Because, I mean, it hasn't happened, at least at a federal level, and we're falling short in California.
So what I've learned is that there's a difference between policy and politics. So policy are, you know, are the good ideas that I bring them as academics, the well-researched ideas, the passionate, well thought out ideas that advocates like Elizabeth Calvin and her colleagues bring them. And we see a lot of agreement, like, oh, this makes sense. And then their job is the politics. And that's when you hear terms like, this would be a heavy lift, or we don't want to, it's not strategic to use energy to try to get the United States to ratify the UN Convention of the Rights of the Child. And so there's a lot of political calculations that come into play. But what I found when working with lawmakers is that these issues involving children, and particularly these issues that Human Rights Watch chose to look at, they fundamentally resonate with people because we all believe in the value of protecting childhood. But politics sometimes gets in the way.
I want to move on to corporal punishment, because the Human Rights Watch believes corporal punishment should be prohibited at home. And that at home is really like the operative word for me, because I always typically thought of corporal punishment within like schools, you know, from like decades ago, like my mom would tell me about it. But some states have banned certain types of corporal punishment that could lead to serious injury or death. But broadly speaking, it's not prohibited really in any state at home. Some may view it as discipline. Others view it as child abuse disguised as discipline. From a juvenile justice perspective, what are some of the challenges of proposing and passing laws to ban corporal punishment at home?
So I think we have to keep in mind that we have a child welfare system that is also very racially biased and is overburdened. So this is not my area of expertise, but I think it's important that when we pass legislation, it's that we look to make sure that we're not creating unintended consequences. I believe that children should be protected from corporal punishment. I don't know the political calculations that have gone into California having its current stance, but this also kind of brings us back to a very important point about youth justice and about the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is that none of these issues are in isolation. The UN Convention of the Rights of the Child, every single right is recognized as interdependent. And so all of these issues, we see, we don't know the exact numbers. We're not tracking it well in California, but it seems like the majority of kids in the juvenile legal system have had involvement in the child welfare system. And most of them have some kind of trauma, whether it's physical, emotional, or neglect. And so, you know, I don't know the precise answer to these questions, but it is, I can see that these issues are very interrelated.
Well, Elizabeth Calvin, can you weigh in on this when it comes to corporal punishment in the home? And I guess when we get to corporal, that's kind of a formal term. Are we talking about like something like spanking, or what are we talking about when we're talking about it within a home?
Well, the definition of corporal punishment, or one definition at least, is the use of physical force to cause pain. And to use that in the context of punishing. And I've heard lots of different things raised in terms of, you know, don't tell me what to do with my kid, you know, kind of thing. Or, you know, people saying that it's a cultural thing to use physical force as a form of punishment.
And passed down from generation to generation as well. You know, like, Oh, well, that's what happened to me when I was a kid.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the things that we have in California that's a really big benefit is, like with Liz, Dr. Barnard here, and also Dr. Abrams, I mean, I think we have academics who are doing research and showing what works and what doesn't work. And there is really quite a bit of research showing that corporal punishment is ineffective, doesn't work to correct behavior. And in fact, it's harmful. And there's research that shows it's harmful to development. And there's an association between corporal punishment and mental health problems, aggression in childhood, aggression in adulthood, delinquent behavior, impaired cognitive activity of children. These should be enough for people to change their perspective on whether physical force that is intended to cause pain is the right way to correct behavior.
I want to ask both of you this. I'll start with you, Elizabeth Calvin. What gives you optimism in the future in California?
I think the thing that gives me the most optimism are my partners in this work, which are many, many community-based groups and individuals who have had personal experience, whether it's personal experience with child marriage or personal experience with getting the sentence of life with no possibility of parole, and just being, I guess, adjacent to them as they work on behalf of other people to keep these human rights violations from happening to others. It's just really inspiring, and it makes me feel like we are going to get there. The U.S. will eventually ratify the Convention on the Rights of the Child, and we'll get the states to a point where children are really valued and taken care of.
Dr. Barnard?
Oh, I love that response. So the children, I'm a pediatrician and researcher, and in my clinical work, I do spend time with young people who are involved in the juvenile legal system. These are kids who are going through a lot of tough stuff, and they are so strong, so kind, so respectful, and they give me a lot of hope. I think the progress that I've seen is also very exciting. 6 years ago, we weren't talking about the minimum age of young people's involvement in the juvenile court, and now we're talking about it on NPR. It's great. And I'm also part of a project looking at children's rights and for workarounds. How can we move forward to protect children's rights? And we've interviewed people in the United States and all around the world, and there's a lot that can be done. So that is very exciting, and there's a lot that's happening.
Finally, this is likely, I mean, for me, I was shocked multiple times, is going to be new for a lot of people to take in, and there's going to be a good amount of possibly marinating following listening to this. What do you want listeners to take away from this scorecard and this conversation? Dr. Barnard, I'll start with you.
We got a D. That's unacceptable. We deserved it. This report makes sense. I've read it very carefully. I've read the methodology. Nobody is happy with the D grade. We have to do better, and we can do better.
Elizabeth Calvin?
Yeah, just the same thing as if your kid came home with a D on a report card. I think, you know, you sit down and you figure out, how do we change this? What's the hard work that needs to happen? You know, where does the support need to happen? What needs to change? Because these are all goals that every single Californian should be behind. And if we work together on it, I think we can get there.
Thank you both for taking the time and sharing your work.
Thank you, Vicky.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Elizabeth Calvin with Human Rights Watch's Children's Division and Dr. Elizabeth Barnard, a professor of pediatrics at UCLA and juvenile justice policy advisor. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Sacramento Ballet has brought creativity and joy for nearly 70 years, and this season kicks off this week with its Ballet and Beer series. But it also comes with a brand new addition, a second company. Anthony Krutzkamp is the artistic and executive director for the Sacramento Ballet and joins us to get us up to speed. Nice to see you, Anthony.
Good morning.
So let's start with a big headline. What was your vision for this second company?
You know, when you think about what dancers have to go through in order to get a job, they have to fly, they have to go sometimes other countries. What we wanted to do is create a space where we could bring 16 to 20 people make them just as good as professionals, also help them write resumes, help them contact different artistic directors that we may know, and have the easiest way to get a job, not only just in our company, but in any company.
How was the response like?
Way too many resumes.
That's a good problem to have.
Yes, we've expanded. So we have 20 right now. I believe last year we had 13.
And who's going to be directing the new second company?
Joe Marlowe Kurtzkamp.
What can people expect? This is a wonderful addition, and this is the 68th season. What can people expect for this season?
Well, the season in general, we start off with beer and ballet, which is everyone's favorite. You know, bike dog beer.
It's a good pairing.
Wine, absolutely.
Food trucks.
You know, this is the time we have 23-year-olds and 99-year-olds in the crowd. But then Nutcracker. We're revisiting our brand new Nutcracker and adding elements to it, and more children's roles and more second company roles. After that is Swan Lake, which I'm very excited about. That's probably the ballet that I performed the most when I was dancing. Mm. So taking what I learned from like pieces I did in Japan to parts of America and splicing them together for one great Swan Lake, I'm really excited about. And then two triple bills, which are what I tried to do is program things that happened all over the world. So in Sacramento, you can come to the Sophia Theater and you can see visions from different choreographers from everywhere.
What does it tell you that with the second company, you know, you had a good problem with the kind of response that you received because there was interest from across the country? What does this tell you about kind of the desire for education and training?
Yeah, well, especially with the pandemic, you know, some of these dancers lost a whole year to dancing in their kitchens on Zoom.
I watched a lot of them.
Absolutely. So bringing them in, we actually have the ability to kind of polish their technique, and they know this. You know, there's an immediacy that they need in order to receive a job. And so really what they're looking for is that little tiny bit above syllabus that we can give to them.
Mm. What goes into the lift of creating this new edition?
Well, finding talent is number one. Number two, we have to make sure that we have repertoire that makes everyone well-rounded. So you're going to want your classical base, but then you're going to need neoclassical. You're going to need modern. You're going to need contemporary. And they're going to have to learn it all at the same time. And we're going to have to wash, rinse, repeat all the way till May to make sure the most well-rounded individuals that will audition for our company.
I'm sure, you know, from now until May or the months leading up to now until May go by and kind of like a blank.
It's so funny you say that. At the end of every fiscal year, I always ask myself, did that actually happen? It happened so quickly. And also watching them grow, you can blink and all of a sudden they're better, which is unbelievable. They work so incredibly hard that it passes by so fast.
So talk to us, share with us some of the new and returning artists that people can expect.
Okay, so every single person signed their contract from last year that I offered, so that's great. But Bobby Briscoe, who's one of their town favorites, mm-hmm. he received a rehearsal director position in Germany.
Oh, wow. So he left. Overseas.
Overseas, which when we had a Zoom and I said, you need to go. There's only 0.3% of any of us making it to the afterlife of dance. So he left. But we have hired Philip Rakamura to take his position. We've also added a few different men. Victor Maguad, Eugene Obie, Hugo Wusong Frediani, and Gianluca Bianconcini.
Wow.
So, two of which haven't arrived yet. I think Hugo arrives on Wednesday and Gianluca on Thursday.
You know, last season, if I'm correct, last season was kind of like the first since everything really just came to a halt with the pandemic. How do you reflect on that time and really that energy and seeing people in person, you know, taking in all the hard work that goes on with Sacramento Ballet?
I think we all collectively had tears of joy opening night of Nutcracker. Just because we didn't have anything to share. I mean, ballet dance in general can't live in a void, you know. So, I mean, just that was the most amazing experience. I was very worried about the dancers coming back and injuries, right? So that's where I was walking on eggshells. I think for them, it was just like walking on clouds.
Right.
They just, yeah, reflecting back on that, it seems so long to get to that season. It's every day we would go in and there'd be three of us in a building that's, you know, 27,000 square feet. And it just seemed like we were waiting forever. And then it was just the most joyous thing to come back. And I think we all forgot what it was like to sweat that much.
Yeah. I'm sure that was just like the perfect fuel for the momentum for the 68th season.
Yes. Because the best part is the dancers were so in shape, and they went in the off season. They go and they dance different places, do different things. They came back incredibly, like I said, in shape, fit, ready to go. Beer and Ballet is looking very good right now. I just watched a run through last week and we'll tech this week. It's just the momentum feels good. And it also feels happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, walking in the building, I feel like I skip in every day and everyone else does also.
Well, finally, since we're going to be kicking off with Beer and Ballet, you know, this isn't the first go around. I believe it's the 29th year. So it's got a lot of good practice. It's obviously successful. People are interested. What should they expect this weekend?
Well, we have 10 different choreographers. So I've asked every dancer choreographer to keep it under 8 minutes, which they did. So we have anything from 3 minutes to 8 minutes. We'll have two intermissions, bike dog, beer. The hardest part is just programming it to make sure that no one dances too close together in each piece, because, you know, with 22 dancers and 10 pieces, people are working hard.
So a lot of creativity to wash down with a local pint of beer, which is included in the ticket, and some yummy food trucks. It's going to be a wonderful weekend. Anthony, thank you so much for getting us up to speed. I'm excited.
Thank you.
Anthony Kretzkamp is the artistic and executive director for the Sacramento Ballet, kicking off the 68th season this weekend, which includes the addition of a second ballet company. That's it for Insight today. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.